Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, and environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal well-being, the well-being of our communities, and everything that's going on in our interconnected world. You know, we are basically, I know this as someone who's been a science reporter and a health and environmental reporter, you know, we're basically not really wired biologically to easily be able to manage the and understand and grasp and sort of really intuitively, you know, get and plan for and respond to all of the complexity of modern civilization in our interconnected world. And so, in addition to my own journalism, book writing on places like Alternating, EcoWatch, Truth Digging, Truth Out, and in the past on the Huffington Post, as well as this radio program, I really try to bring in all of these things because, you know, we each have our own human focus, what's kind of paramount and, you know, front and center for us in our own lives, and that can be very different for, you know, for other people with different life experiences, different places, different professional specialties, different, you know, come from different ethnicities, different families. I mean, there are all so many different ways that we each have different perspectives. And as our world becomes more and more divisive, I mean, I think it's really important to, you know, kind of get a sense of the whole. And by talking one by one, as we have over the last, going on now into our ninth year on Connect the Dots, we kind of give a picture of the, you know, broad interconnected jigsaw puzzle that is our interconnected web of life. So that's what we do each week on the show. We talk to different experts and authors, advocates, scientists. And today, I'm really thrilled to be able to have a conversation for you all with someone whose work I have known and admired for a while. And we'll be discussing that as well as the unique perspective that has given her. And today, I think this may be the first time that on the show, I'm delighted to welcome a whistleblower. And my guest today is Lisa Wing. She's one of three whistleblowers featured in a very highly rated and beloved documentary that came out earlier this year on PBS, which many of you may have seen or been aware of. And that is a film called National Bird. Lisa Ling was in the military for many years and was in a position to know about, you know, what was going on in the military and at war in terms of drones, and that was what was covered. She was one of three people profiled in the film National Bird. So I'm happy to welcome Lisa to Connect the Dots. We'll be discussing the film, her background, whistleblowing, and the unique perspective that her life trajectory has given her. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was in the film National Bird, which is basically about three of us, and we all agreed that we wanted to break the silence around the drone program. We were all kind of surprised that civilians knew so little about it.
So, you know, the film is about the drone program, and, you know, was it a deep, dark secret or something kind of hidden in plain sight that people just kind of ignored, or were you really breaking top security clearances to bring this information to the public?
So basically what happened for me is obviously there's three of us. There's one of us, Daniel, that still worked in security, and another one, Heather, who was, her job was basically to watch things over the video screen that provided by the drones and make that call. A very young lady, under the age of 24 years old, was the one that would make that call. Is that a shovel? Is that a weapon? Should we kill this person or blow up this thing? And then there was me, and I worked on pretty much the technology that had to do with the drone program. And I know that inside the drone program that there was a serious lack of humanity. So when I left the drone program, I was compelled to go to Afghanistan and meet some of the people impacted so terribly with our tax dollars in our name, face to face.
So in other words, you went from being in the military to then going to the targets, so to speak, the people, the populations that were the targets of this war activity,
yes,
in order to kind of really understand the full breadth of what you had been part of and what was going on. That must have been an amazing experience. What was it like?
You know, it's really amazing to me how the narrative is guided by the public narrative. The things that people hear and see and say is guided in a very large way by the news media, Hollywood, and just the public discourse. Because once upon a time, we used to have hijackers, and they would hijack airplanes. Now they're terrorists. When you would say things like about Muslims, you would understand in the 70s, that they were one of the most hospitable peoples that you'd ever want to meet. I mean, there was the what they called the hippie trail, where people would go to Afghanistan and walk across the whole country and meet people and enjoy some of that hospitality. They were the breadbasket of the world. Now today, you know, flip the page for some years, and everybody, when you talk about a Muslim, the idea of a terrorist is the first thing that comes to mind. And there's something mm-hmm. wrong with this. There's something horribly wrong with this. I mean, not everybody
who...
You're
saying the people who, from humanity and culture, have been seen and admired, you know, for many years by all different peoples, are now kind of only defined according to their... you know, military opposition to whatever, you know, we have going on that we're, you know, concerned about. That's, you know, that you're right. That is a really, really sad thing. What was your specific role in the military? Like, what was it that you did?
Well, I joined the Army as a nurse because mm-hmm. I really wanted to be able to treat everyone. And I've always mm-hmm. had technology as a hobby and medicine as a hobby. I've always. And I've always known that the two were going to merge. And so while I was in, I was asked to swap over to technology, which I did. And I wasn't thinking, okay, I'm going to be part of a system that kills people from the other side of the world. I was thinking maybe I can help people with their databases or, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But with drones, I mean, technology took a dark turn. We sit here and we talk about and discuss how basically we're above terror, right? And we're having a war on terror. But from the ground, if you're a civilian, I mean, if you think about it right now, wherever anybody who's listening is sitting, look to your left and look to your right. And do you care about the person that's sitting next to you? How would you feel if there was a device flying over your head where you didn't know if in the next moment that person would still be there or end up in pieces? And this lasts for hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades. We're in decades now. That's
terrible. You mean decades of drone warfare? Is that what you're referring to?
By decades?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't know...
So what means drone warfare? Can you just... for anybody that might be completely unacquainted with it, what it actually is, what is meant by, you know, drone warfare?
So what they call them is unmanned aerial vehicles. I mean, there's also unmanned tanks. There's unmanned vehicles. But what we're talking about here is like Predator drones. They're aircraft that are unmanned. And what they mean by unmanned is that there's no human being on the aircraft. There are weapons on the aircraft. And I don't think of them as unmanned. I think of them as hypermanned because they need a whole lot of people to maintain their presence in the air.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you any specifics about that. That's pretty much all I can tell you. And what happens is through the collection of data, the collection of all kinds of data, there are decisions made, and the clarity as to who makes these decisions is not available either, as to what a target is going to be. And then that target is taken out. And there's no oversight. There's no drone-specific doctrine. And there, up until very recently, was very little reporting on the civilian casualties. And there's still very little reporting. Most of the reporting we get is from wonderful agencies like Reprieve and Reporters Without Borders and civilian entities and NGOs that let people know how many civilians are killed in drone strikes. And the movie National Bird is talks about one of the only, I believe it is the only drone strike investigation that's ever been made public. And it was General McChrystal's investigation. He's actually in the film. And it's about a strike where 23 innocent people were killed.
That's terrible. And were these strikes going on and the American public didn't kind of know that it was happening? Or was it just kind of regarded as, oh, well, that's what we have to do in a war kind of thing?
Well, the narrative was drones save lives.
Uh-huh.
That because our soldiers and airmen don't have to go overseas and hit the pavement, they don't have to be quote-unquote boots on the ground, that drones save lives. And at one time, drones were basically overwatch to the troops on the ground. So if somebody was coming over a hill or an IED or anything like that, and I think there's value in that. But once they put weapons on drones, the mission changed. Once you put a weapon on anything, that thing is a primary thing that's meant to kill. So the idea anymore that drones save lives, in my worldview, is a misnomer. The other thing is, there's a lot of damage caused by the individuals who work in the drone program, so much so that they're actually building psychiatric facilities right outside the doors to keep people in and functional. On CorpWatch, CorpWatch.com, there's some more information about the drone program that Protap Chatterjee actually did a wonderful investigative expose about the corporation. I mean, this is the whole thing is Andrew Feinstein wrote a wonderful book about the global arms trade, and it is called, let me see, The Shadow World. And this is the under, I mean, we're spending billions of dollars on this technology. And it's perpetuating wars. Right now it seems to be okay with the American public that we've been in not necessarily America's longest wars, because I would contend that's still with First Nation peoples and we're still technically at war in Korea, but we've been in Afghanistan for what, over 17 years now.
Uh-huh.
And nobody, where is the outcry? We're worried about infrastructure and bridges and where we're not spending our money in our own country. Where is the outcry about the billions of dollars or the fact that the Pentagon has a legal requirement to be audited and it is not being audited? We're privileged enough.
When this film was made, you know, like, you reveal this information, you know, did you have to quit the military? Were people upset with you? You know, what happened?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's people upset with me occasionally. there's technical glitches that I have that I can attribute to maybe secret squirrels. being a whistleblower is not an easy choice to make, and there is a price that comes with it. But what I also want to say, too, is that it is not a requirement that one breaks the law to be a whistleblower. I mean, all it is that you report fraud, waste, abuse, crimes, you know, and you don't need to reveal secrets to do that, especially in the drone program, basically sharing our story, the experiences that we had while we were in the program, trying to get the public to see it, to pay attention. But what seems to be happening is when war comes on television in the United States, we merely change the channel. There's countries all over the world where individuals do not have that kind of privilege, and they are living in terror. So in my world estimation, we are fighting a war of terror, not on terror, not against terror.
Wow. What was it like when you were actually in the thing, when you were doing this, and when your concerns about it were mounting? Were there other people who also were having problems with it? Secretive and pretending to go along with it, and then we're like, you know, one day I've had enough. I mean, you know, like, what is this? Being concerned about, you know, and feeling like, oh, well, maybe we're not, like, as much as we like to think we are. Did you ever try talking to anyone? Did you kind of know that that wouldn't go down well? And, you know, what was that like?
What was it like? Blowing the whistle,
Was there anyone else who had a problem? Was it something that was discussed among you and the other people there? You know, maybe don't, you know, this is weird, or was it, you know, you would never say anything to anyone about, you know, what your perceptions were coming around to?
It was interesting. I mean, the whole program itself is designed so that the people who operate within it are unaware of what exactly the impact they have at the distant end, at the places where we're at war. So what happened for me is, handed a couple of wards on my way out the door, and one of them basically said that that the technology that I was working on during the time I was working on it impacted 121,000 people. Now, in America, talk about drones on the news, those aren't the kind of numbers that you hear. And I'd like to point out that this was reported on one individual, that would be me, in a 2-year period. And that number, again, is 121,000 people.
Wow.
And now that's not a secret. These awards are meant to be hung on the wall, something to be proud of. But I wasn't proud of that award. I got another award that talks about another 450 individuals who I know died. And some IEDs as well. And these are numbers that I walk around with knowing about every day. When I hear on the news that there was one or two civilians killed, maybe. We're in the low hundreds, maybe. But in reality, what is on over there is that there are young people looking on a culture that has been around thousands upon thousands of years longer than our own, that there's a very limited understanding. When you're actually boots on the ground, if I lived there in Afghanistan for 10 years, I don't believe that I could have a thorough understanding of such a complex culture and beautiful culture. And yet, here we are believing that we know, and we don't. And the evidence, you know, if what we were doing was an effective counterinsurgency strategy, the evidence would be that the wars would be winding down, ending. It's 17 years later.
Wow.
So, I mean, don't listen to
people. Yeah.
You don't have to. Pay attention and know that there are women and children and mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers that are being blown up daily. And Yemen, there's a complete and total genocide happening. A genocide happening to a culture that's been around for thousands upon thousands of years. And Syria and the human flow. And all of these refugees are human beings, and yet we in America change the channel when the news disturbs us. How inhumane is it? Where is our collective home humanity? How is that on our own? We carry that. This is our tax dollars at work. We are all complicit.
That's powerful. That's very profound. So, you know, we're focusing on some little thing in our own lives that gives us pleasure, that we're working on or we think is important. And meanwhile, even as we don't pay attention to it, we are contributing, you know, through our taxes and supporting that this goes on and that these people die. And then we are told something to believe that will make that acceptable in our, you know, in our view.
So, you're
really calling attention to something that is really incredibly important. And thank you for doing this. You know, we have been, I'm talking today with Lisa Ling, who's one of the featured whistleblowers.
A film called National Bird that was released in 2017. And, you know, who was working in drone warfare behind the scenes and came forward along with a couple of other whistleblowers to shed light and to reveal to Americans what is being done in our name. But I encountered Lisa because we are Facebook friends, and I often, you know, I over time I've really found that her posts and her insights are really kind of awesome, you know, and you know, or from a different perspective. And so, you know, one of the things I'd love to talk about with you at this portion of the show is, Lisa, is, you know, this experience, obviously, you know, it's a life-changing, life-forming experience. What, you know, whatever you were about and what you thought was going on and what you hoped you were doing that was helpful, you know, was dramatically shifted by participation, working for a government, you know, in something that was, you know, supposed to be an okay thing, and then you find out that this is going on. One of the things that I've long noticed about you in following your Facebook postings is, you know, that you have a very different take, a different perspective that you bring to bear on, you know, what's going on in our reality. The things that you notice, your lens, is somehow very unique, and I find it very enlightening. How has this experience of being the whistleblower and knowing what's going on more behind the scenes kind of given you a different insight than you feel that maybe, other folks have? You know, like the average person, like how is your viewpoint different, and what is it that you've learned, you know, that in effect you're kind of teaching people to see? You know, not just about drones, but just about, you know, all of the things that are going on right now that are more and more troubling in our government and in our world.
Well, I'm kind of, my perspective is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that I've spent more time in the war corps than in the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So my vantage is radically different than people who have spent their lives working for peace. And and some people would call that tainted, or perhaps, I don't know, institutionalized or, you know, colonized. And some of that, to a certain extent, may be true. But what I also see is that there's a wholesale binary thinking that you're either in the peace movement or the war movement, that you're either Democrat or Republican, that you're either right or wrong, that there's no middle ground. There's no middle ground in our politics. There's no middle ground in our educational system. There's no middle ground anywhere. And it, and what that's created, or at least from my vantage point, I don't know, I'm not a highly educated person or anything of that nature, but what it's created for me is this this opinion that we're kind of at a stalemate. That even, you know, the peace movement attacks recruiters, like service members, recruiters. These are young 18 to 24-year-olds that may want medical insurance. They may want a college education. They may have been completely impoverished in their families. And we're going through a whole technological revolution. And there are entire systems that have kept people financially afloat in the system of finance and everything else that we live in, that are being yanked from under their feet. This is the whole demographic that voted for President Trump. And we've ignored them. We, as a country, have looked to New York and California and pretty much ignored all of these people. We keep saying, well, we don't want any more fracking. But we're not saying, well, how do we help the workers? Well, the military-industrial complex is saying, I know how we help the workers. We can turn the people in Appalachia into technologists, and they can work on drone technology, and they can feed this big beast. They're not being ignored by them. And watching this happen, and I'm watching this paralysis happen with the anti-war movement, in how we're trapped in some sort of a former way of opposing war by standing in front of military bases that just based on the circumstances has been ineffective. And we need to make some sort of a 180-degree turn where when we ask for $15 wages for these young people, what happens when they then can't afford babysitting or food stamps? How are we providing for that? In other countries, this same sort of dynamic happens. In Afghanistan, it happened with the Taliban. The people in the rural regions of Afghanistan, if the Taliban showed up and fed their children, what are they going to do? They're going to turn to whatever feeds their children. And in many ways, we accept that in developing nations, well, they were desperate. But here in the United States, we kind of don't. We just pat ourselves on the back and move on.
And so here's the whole side of this that you're seeing, which is that people are being, you know, kind of driven through economic necessity to, you know, to certain desperate life choices that are much harsher than what the people kind of having the narrative understand going on. This is what I think I hear you saying. And so, you know, we kind of go, well, why can't we reason with them or whatever? And, you know, what you're pointing out is that there's a whole, you know, large percentage of the population has systemically been driven into a certain position. And then we act as if, you know, oh, if we could only talk to them, you know, we'd persuade them of something better. Which
the better is offered by the military-industrial complex. We can just take a look. So, I mean, we can look at, there are so many things that we can look at. We can look at our, you know, the high school to prison pipeline. We can look at how the military-industrial complex is all, I mean, for any other way to put it, all up in our educational system. From the moment that schools get federal funding because they've given the names to recruiters to be called for military service, when most parents do not know that they can just simply call their school and take their children's names out of that pot and say, I don't want my child's name being given to recruiters. They can just do that as a parent or as a guardian.
And then as you go on in the school system and you get to universities and you hear people clamoring for STEM, you start to understand that there are actual, in Australia, here, Britain, that there are research facilities. And there are scholarships funded for people to work in these research facilities that are doing work for DARPA and doing work on artificial intelligence and all of these. And I'm not against technology. I absolutely love technology. I mean, I'm a technologist, basically, you know. I'm a hacker, you know. But what it's being used for and the research that's being paid for is pretty much, you know, to kill. And we keep saying things like drones are accurate and all of that, and they're not. I mean, any time you put a laser on a missile and you say go hit where the laser's pointed, it's going to hit that target. So in that way, it's accurate, but we're asking the wrong questions. Where are we getting the data? We all know that this technology uses GPS. How many of us have went to a pizza parlor and ended up at an ice cream shop because the GPS got it wrong? People in large cities experience that often.
Yes.
And yet we're using that same technology to decide whether people live or die.
Mm.
And nobody's questioning it.
Mm.
That
just makes more and more people expendable, really.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and if you really want to look at it the way it is, it's black and brown people around the globe. This is what our tax dollars is paying for. So to me, money in the United States and the Western world, money is a signatory of value.
Mm-hmm.
So in the United States, most of our tax dollars is spent on the military-industrial complex. And so to me, that says as a nation, we value war. That's undeniable. That's indisputable. As a nation, the United States of America, based on our spending habits, value war. Is that okay with
you? What you're saying is even if I'm a nursery school teacher, or I'm a musician, I'm doing something benign, I think I'm doing something good, here I am doing something good. That's all going on in a context where the overall net aggregate effect of the activity of my country is violence and destruction.
Yes. And
we pull a curtain on that, is what I hear you say. We pull a curtain on that.
Yeah. And we're, for a developed nation, our life expectancy is getting lower. I don't know that there's a connection. I can't say that I know that. I just suspect that there is. I think that all of our health, and I think we think a lot alike as far as health is concerned, that it's a holistic, that holistic approaches are the best. And I think that part of what we value, what goes on in our lives and all of that stuff has to do with our health and well-being. And I think that if you spend a day watching the news cycle, what are you going to hear? I mean, I remember in the 80s when you turned on the news, you got to hear some plain old Joe get on the news and he got 60 seconds to spout what was on his mind about his own community. That doesn't happen anymore. News is no longer a public service. It's a for-profit venture. And so we're fed this sensationalism so that we can look more and view it more and you know, take in all the commercials and all of that. And I think that that's going to have a direct impact on all of our health and well-being. And, I mean, when I spent time in Afghanistan, oh, my God, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have a day without that pole vaulting over mouse turd, to have just to be able to walk around the woman's garden that's in the middle of Kabul, where they plant roses, where men are not allowed, actually, And it's a beautiful garden, and to walk around there, and it's just so peaceful, so wonderful. And talk to all these women that have such vibrant life histories. And then to hear people here want to teach them how to farm when they've been doing sustainable farming for thousands of years. I think we should be calling them over here teaching us how to farm sustainably, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I just think
in terms of the studies that I'm aware of about the declining American longevity, my understanding of it, and of course these are always, anything like this is always multifactorial, but in terms of what the scientists have looked at and studied, what they have looked at and studied is the obesity of the younger generation and the fact that the consumption of cheap foods, fast foods, soft drinks, foods high in sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and all the rest of that have driven not only adult obesity, which affects, I think a third of the population at this point, but it also affects younger people and children throughout childhood with much earlier incidence of adult onset diabetes happening, when kids are children or teenagers and therefore all the negative health aftermaths of that come earlier than if you were to develop diabetes or become a diabetic as an adult or later in life. So I'm very aware, as a health reporter, of declining longevity due to those factors. But even since those studies were done, I think with suicide and opioid addiction and all of that, what was an original baseline due to our profit-driven food supply and terrible diet, it has now being increased by other negative social factors, of the kind that you're mentioning and the ones that I mentioned as well.
Mm-hmm. So if we take that a step further, we can look at food deserts and we can look at how the government has propped up people or corporations like Walmart and said, okay, we want you to move your buildings. We'll help you pay for the physical plant into these places that are food deserts. And then Walmart finding out that they're not making any money by even having government subsidized buildings in impoverished areas and them moving out of those impoverished areas, leaving once again food deserts for these people who are then forced to eat what is closest to them, which is junk food or McDonald's or whatever, right? But if we take that a step further and take that outside of food deserts, why do people turn to those comfort foods? When I went to Afghanistan, there wasn't a child around me that wanted to go have a Big Mac. Not a one. That wasn't in their, consciousness. They would have chai tea or water or be very happy with it. In fact, I was really happy. I mean, feels so good eating real natural food without GMOs. It's amazing the difference in the food there. But here it's different. And I think that we don't very much take into consideration the social factors that want us to reach for the chocolate chip cookie or that want us while we change the... And I think that a lot of that needs to be looked at in order to solve... these problems are not going to be solved by themselves. They need to be solved in a holistic way. In the same way that our own individual problems need to be solved in some sort of a holistic way. And I don't know any of the answers or anything. I just come up with questions. But
I've long felt is if a fossil fuel company or a pipeline company is able to come in, as, occurred with the Dakota Access Pipeline, it's happening all over the United States, not just in one location. Communities that thought themselves separate from that and safe from harm, hey, one day it can happen there. I've seen it over and over. But if a fuel company can come in by eminent domain and say, we're going to poison your water, we're going to basically poison your food supply because we need to put this pipeline here, or as is occurring in Pennsylvania as we speak, we want to dump our toxic waste from fracking in your community, and you have no right to say you don't want it there. There's a whole protracted lawsuit going on about that over the last several years in the state of Pennsylvania. If they have a right to come in and say that, I don't understand why, you know, somebody doesn't have, you know, a board of public health doesn't have a right to say, we're not producing cheap food and disseminating cheap junk foods with these ingredients that make people sick anymore. Sorry. So that, you know, people have to go cold turkey and they have to eat something healthier, and we're going to make it available and we're going to provide it. You know, I don't understand. If you have a health emergency, you know, it's, of course, you know, the whole notion of, well, I have a right to choose, and if I eat myself into an early death, that's like my choice. You know, we're all free here in America. But, you know, if companies can come in and poison a whole community, like the idea that we could, you know, come in and say, okay, no, we're, you know, these foods will no longer be available. We're not going to be reasoning and begging with you and writing a million books that you won't read to urge you not to eat these foods and instead eat foods that we haven't, you know, subsidized those healthy foods so that you could afford them. You know, it's kind of like that kind of change could happen if we were serious and, you know, actually about helping people's health. And, you know, no one's apologizing when the, you know, the pipeline comes in and poisons the need of American food supply, right? So, in effect, we have voluntarily chosen a poisoned industrial food supply, and then we treat it like, you know, it's eternal. It's immortal. It can never go away. No one can question it. And, you know, we just keep begging people not to eat it.
And again, it's our
best thing for them to eat because of our systemic crisis.
Yeah, it's our value system. When I went to Berlin, the food there is amazing. I mean, and reasonably priced. Here, I mean, it has to do with our values and, you know, what we've given to corporations to be able, I mean, what corporations are legally allowed to do is make money for their shareholders. That's the value. That's the value system that we apparently hold dear because we still have it. And the reason why I say a lot of these things is because one of the strongest lobbies in the United States are the retired set and the elderly. And the reason why I say that is because regardless of how often people have fought against it or tried to eradicate it, Social Security is still here. And it still exists. And that is proof positive that our elderly set has stepped up and come forward to fight for it every time it's been on the chopping block. Because that's something that is of value. Another strong lobby would be all of our students. And we don't see this as being effective means of changing the narrative on what our values are so that we can, I mean, do we value food in this country? Do we value feeding? You know, during the Occupy movement, it was forbidden to feed homeless people. That was treated as a crime. I couldn't believe it. In the United States of America, feeding people who couldn't eat is a crime, and in some cities. And this mm-hmm. goes back to it's our value system, and we're not willing mm-hmm. to admit that this is our value system. And the whole thing mm-hmm. that happened with and all of that that just recently happened with her running for president, you know, she's a good navigator of our financial system. In fact, she's pretty brilliant at it, as evidenced by, you know, and she's done a lot of great things. She's put issues of people of color on the forefront and elevated the black...
Who are you referring to here? Who are you speaking of?
Say again? Oprah.
Okay.
So she's elevated mm-hmm. black voice in Hollywood. And she's done a lot of great things, but again, we're looking for this, like, leader, this fable, this, you know, it's our values, and collectively. It just, I mean, I'm watching it, and I'm finding it amazing. Hopefully, I've applied to UC Berkeley, and hopefully I will get in, and I will get to learn more about the political arena and more about our history, but today is... I mean, just from watching all of this, all I can say is that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I sit here and watch these things and watch people say this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But collectively, we're unable to agree on how to move forward. On how to, you know, make substantive change. The anti world movement doesn't agree. We've just not found a spot of agreement.
I think one of the biggest problems is that we're coming out of an epoch, you know, where we had one party that was, you know, visibly destructive and bigoted, and then another party that, you know, puts a more tolerant face, but actually...
Are they?
There was just a profound disillusionment, you know, occurring.
Well, I mean, under the Democratic administration, we also droned a lot of people.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
At the time,
so the impression is that it's more tolerant, but the actual actions are similar, just as bad, sometimes worse. I mean, you know, so people are confused and disillusioned, and some people reflexively hope that, you know, you know, if our more tolerant group came back, all would be well again. But meanwhile, the mask has been taken off their behavior, you know, from that moment of idealism when President Obama was elected, for example.
Yeah, I mean, both sides, neoconservatives and neoliberals, the goals are the same. Power, money. That's the system that we live in. And all
right.
of us as individuals kind of plug and play into that system.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or whether you're a Republican. It really doesn't. I think we should get rid of the binary two-party system altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, there's, and then we do take the all or nothing approach. It's rich people. It's their fault. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people help whether they're born rich or poor. It's not every rich person. They're as much plug and play into the anybody else. I know people that are fairly well off, and they've tried to invest their money into sustainable projects or what have you, and they've been unable to make money doing that. It's not sustainable for them. Think about that for a moment. The only thing that's making money are destructive of the oil industry, the military-industrial complex. Again, it's back to our values. How do we make it lucrative to use solar energy? I mean, Standing Rock was not only, I did spend months there, Standing Rock was not only a beautiful experiment in how people could live sustainably. It was a beautiful evidence of how people with the value of water, the value of life, the value of elders could live together in community. It's possible. It's evidenced by what happened at Standing Rock. So how do we grow that? How do we make that a priority in our collective consciousness? I mean, I know that right now I watch my sister work 60 hours a week. And she doesn't have time to do much more than work. So she doesn't have time to pay attention to this. So she's one of the ones that'll turn the channel when the war comes on television, right?
All of this
needs to change. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure how we get out of this stalemate that we're in. Or what the next steps are. But I do know that we have to, I mean, there are certain things that to me are simple that we could all agree with. I think that we could all agree that having armed drones is terror and that we can't fight a war on terror with terror. I think that we can get this entire country to agree on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just think about looking to the left and looking to the right and not knowing if you're going to be exploded in the next moment, if you don't understand that living like that day in and day out is terror, then there's something definitely wrong. So we can mm-hmm. take that and move forward with that idea and say, mm-hmm. hey, let's dismantle. We're never going to put them back. We're never going to ban them. And with food deserts and things like that, farming, God, there's just, it's such a wreck. I mean, here we are sitting here wanting to, or a lot, I guess some people want to build a wall. I'd like to see more bridges built. I think that there's so much that, I mean, we need to start thinking of ourselves as global citizens if we're going to work within a global economy.
Mm-hmm.
And look at humanity everywhere and stop looking at, you know. And I think that we're living by our own, I mean, that we've built a roadmap. I mean, that we call the clash of civilizations. I'm in disagreement. I don't think that needs to happen. I don't think it is happening. I think that we're fueling the fires mm-hmm. over money and you know, I always mm-hmm. joke around, got to stop embracing our inner chimp. And, you know, chimpanzees, as a rule, they live for power, you know, they, and it's all, you know, who gets up in the pecking order in their communities, and we start to embrace our inner bonobo.
So could you tell our listeners, you know, a little bit about the differences between the chimps and the bonobos? People may not be familiar with that. I think it's a really wonderful thing to think about. Can you explain that a little bit? And kind of coming down to the last like 6 minutes of the show, so like a brief explanation maybe of that.
So basically chimpanzees, they live in colonies and their goal is to get higher in the pecking order so they can have access to more resources. Mm-hmm. And bonobos, they live in smaller groups with more resources available to them. And what they do is they share their resources, they sit around having sex, they enjoy their food, and they're not trying to get higher up in any pecking order. They just want to be happy.
Mm.
So they just want to be fat and happy. I mean, that's just really general, but I think the idea is getting more, having more, wanting more is just, it's unsustainable in a,
mm-hmm.
on a planet with limited resources.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's a treadmill, but, you know, kind of going nowhere. But people also are doing it because they, you know, they think that's the only way to have enough. If we had not less safety nets, but more, so that, you know, everyone could feel some sense of support in having enough, then, that you know, we wouldn't be on that kind of a treadmill. That would be a way, you know, societal way to kind of get us off the treadmill and into, you know, a better and more humane and sustainable way of life. I mean, that would be an interesting thing to bring about. I don't know exactly how that could come about, but I've heard, but you know, the idea of a guaranteed baseline income is kind of in line with that rather than, you know, a fifth house for somebody who's already got, you know, a bunch of mega mansions. I mean,
there's a bunch
but,
of you
know,
once mega now.
What?
There's a bunch of blighted mega mansions all over the country right now.
Yeah. That's true. Mm. So, you know, in effect, we're looking to wealthy people to turn that around, but you know, but no one's doing it. No one's turning it around, really.
Long,
you know,
long
and
wealthy people, they don't know. I mean, a lot of them don't know how to turn it around either. I mean, it's
right.
required. Collectivism is required. These are things
right.
we have to agree on. Everything we've ever done in this country, we've come to a consensus and moved forward.
Right.
And part of the problem now is we cannot come to any sort of consensus.
Right. Well, that's very true. You know, there's a huge problem coming to a consensus right now that couldn't be more of a problem. Well, we're coming to the end of our show, and it's been wonderful talking with you, Lisa Ling, featured whistleblower in National Bird, just about like some of these systemic issues and what it looks like when you sort of step outside of your box and take responsibility for, what your participation is doing. This isn't to guilt trip anybody, but something that, you know, we could all think about and, you know, do in different ways. Like, there's always a little room for finger pointing, but I think that's a really, really constructive thing, and that more of us need to do, more of us need to model for others and take that risk, as you have done, Lisa, and kind of stepping beyond the expected role, really looking at the impact and looking at ways to do it differently. So, thank you so much for being with me on Connect the Dots today. And, good luck with your, I hope you get into the graduate program and continue doing the great work and offering the great insights that you are. And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. You know, look up National Bird. It's still showing. You might be able to see it online. It's certainly worthwhile. And think about how we can maybe become whistleblowers in our own lives. What was that, Lisa? What?
It's on Amazon, Netflix. It's available.
Great. That's wonderful. So, by all means, see it. And, I love the idea of a whistleblower as a role model for, how to make the change. I think it's just beautiful. Thank you again for being a whistleblower and modeling, how to take a bigger picture look, Lisa Ling. And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Heads up, keep marching forward and standing tall with all our relations. Be well in the coming week.